two stories being told, aren't there? The first story is God's story. He's telling us, he's teaching us, that he is the only one that can satisfy the deepest desires of your heart. That he is all you need. Everything else is futile. Not only does he bring us salvation, but peace. The second story is the story of our enemy. It's a story that's born out of jealousy and hatred, rebellion. He promises to bring peace as well. In fact, he promises that you can get it. You can achieve it. You can create this for yourself. You can be the God of your own life. Our enemy is truly a very, very powerful, powerful being. He's capable of giving us a little taste, the little hook, the little fix. Then we're snagged. And at the end of his story, all there is bondage and oppression. You're trapped. There's chaos. God's story brings order. And our enemy's story brings chaos. And this is where we find the children of Israel. They were brought into Egypt, not just to survive a famine, but they were brought into Egypt to thrive as a people. They were given the best, the absolute best. And life was good for them for a very, very long time. During that passage of time, the people begin to believe in the system rather than God. Not only are they in Egypt, but now as time goes along, Egypt, this world, is in them. Idols are interesting things. There's a carved image. There's an image of something. It represents an unseen reality. We know that that stone is a nothingness, but the reality behind it is actually quite real, powerful. In other words, we have this physical, visible, tactile thing that you can touch and you can see it, experience it with your senses, but behind it is the real and the powerful, the supernatural. Deuteronomy 32, 17 and 18 tells us, they made him, God, jealous. Remember he says, I'm a jealous God? They made him jealous with their foreign gods and angered him with their detestable idols. They sacrificed to demons. Now that's a very important thing for you to understand there. What was going on in Egypt and then later in Canaan was they were worshiping demons, which are not God. Gods they had not known, gods that had recently appeared, gods your fathers did not fear. You deserted the rock who fathered you, and you forgot the God who gave you birth. And that's what happened in the course of this time. As they thrived, they began to trust the system, and they forgot God. And then Exodus 1:8 says, then, kind of go, uh-oh. Then a new king who did not know about Joseph, he didn't know the past, he didn't know the history, he didn't know the relationship between these cultures. He didn't know about Joseph, the one who saved Egypt. Did not know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt. He didn't remember. He didn't respect. Exodus 2:23. During that long period, we're told the king of Egypt died and the Israelites groaned in their slavery. See, you follow the enemy's lie and you end up in bondage, oppressed, overburdened. That's where the Israelites are. They groaned in their slavery and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. The word cry is ze'akah, ze'akah in Hebrew. It's a desperate outcry. I don't know if you've ever had that. Maybe in great pain physically. Maybe in great pain emotionally or intellectually. Ah! You cry out. Can't take it anymore. It's too much, is what they're saying. But they didn't cry out to God. They just cried out. They just cried out. Listen to Moses at the burning bush. He has a question. This is Exodus 3:13. But Moses protested, which is interesting. He's arguing with the bush here. He's protesting. He's already gotten to the point where he is mesmerized by the miraculous here. His shoes are off. He's fallen face down. He realizes this is God. And he's protesting. We stand back in amazement sometimes and we see these people protest God, argue with God. Peter, surely not, Lord. How often do you protest? How often do you argue? If I go to the people of Israel and tell them this, the God of your ancestors has sent me, they will ask me what? What are they going to ask? What's his name? I cannot imagine my children or my grandchildren or my great-grandchildren not knowing the name of Jesus Christ. But here, they don't know Elohim or Yahweh, should we say. What should I tell them? He says, turn to Exodus chapter 6. Verses 6 through 9. Exodus 6, verses 6 through 9. Exodus 6, 6 through 9. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord. And I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. This is a very important word. Then you will know. When will they know? After. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God who brought you, past tense, out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. And I will bring you to the land that I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham and Isaac and to Jacob. And I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord. Very important to notice, he says, then you will know. First this, and then. It's a very important word also, to know. How many of you remember the Hebrew word for knowing here? Yada, not yada, 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 yada. It's yada. How many of you know the Greek word? Nope. You're funny. You sound better when she's here, actually. Do you know that? Oida. Similar, but the Greek word for this expression of knowledge is oida. The word we're looking at here is yada. To know. To experience. To know by experience. This goes way beyond cognitively understanding something. It means to know it because you've experienced it. Involves deep emotional connections characterized by interaction, loyalty, and commitment. In other words, he's going to tell them his name. They have a cognitive understanding, but then after he does this, 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 and this, they will have known him by experience. Continue to read in verse 9. Moses reported this to the Israelites, but they did not listen. Why? What does it say? I assume you have the right answer because I have no idea what you just said. That was, because of their discouragement and cruel bondage. What did they know? What were they experiencing? You understand? This was more prominent. This had a larger effect in their lives at that moment. Discouragement. Ah, crying out. Bondage. Slavery. This is what they're experiencing. God said, I will, I will, I will, I will. Then you will know. And he takes his time. It's very strategic. As he reveals himself, not just to the Israelites, but to the Egyptians, to Pharaoh. Pharaoh is the ruler, and as I want you to remember, think of him as the highest of high priests. He's the number one priest. He's believed to be the most powerful person on earth. He speaks to, he talks to demons. And they have legitimate supernatural power. He sets up a system that indoctrinates them into this ritualistic life of honoring these demon gods, serving these demon gods in their families, in their homes, in the marketplace, all the time, all day long, hoping to please these demon gods so that these demon gods would bless them. Think about him. I'm sure you've seen pictures of pharaohs depicted, but think about this, some of the things that they have. This is such a strange thing throughout history, but there's this outstretched hand, And it's a symbol of power. Overcoming enemies, like cutting them off, swiping them out of the way. Power. You know what a flail is? It's a weapon of war. It's a long staff with a big club end. The higher in rank you are, the more ornate it is. And Pharaoh has a flail. He sits on his throne with this flail in his hand. Beautifully ornate, but deadly. It's a weapon. It's a symbol of authority. Not just power, but authority to have power. He has this flail. He's the facilitator. He's the one who talks to the gods and speaks with their authority. What does he have in the other hand? A shepherd's crook. Shepherds use one end of it to guide and steer and prod the sheep along. And the other end with the crook to catch them and pull them if need be. And he holds that. Not only does he have the power of the gods in one hand, but he has power and authority over the people in the other hand. That's fear. It's awe-striking almost. What does he have on his head? What's on the crown there? A snake. I don't know, that's not very ornamental today. I don't see a whole lot of people going around with snakes on their forehead. If we did, we'd start to get a little worried. Serpents are, they're dangerous. They're poisonous. They're really fast. How many of you have ever had an experience with a snake? Raise your hand. I've been bit. It's interesting. They're fast. I didn't know what to do. I just sort of stood still. What do? I was actually stepping on it. and it was biting at my boot. And I was like, I don't know, because I wasn't going to move that foot. I was not going to move that foot. I just stayed there for a while. They're fast and they're dangerous. They're striking. And that's on his head. So you just have to soak this in. Him on his throne is one thing. But the power and authority of the gods in one hand and the authority over the people on the other and the fear or that striking quick movement right on his forehead. You got to have that in your head. Can you imagine what this is like for Moses to walk back in? He hasn't been there in 40 years. Talking about someone in the van this morning was talking about high school. I haven't been high school in 30 years. I don't want to walk back in. It's scary. Scary. As Moses walks back into Egypt. And all of it starts to come back. And those gods are everywhere. They're on every corner. If you've ever seen some of the depictions and even the pictures of these gods on all the corners. He's getting closer and closer to the temple, the palace where Pharaoh lives. Hallway to the throne room. So he walks down and it's lit. The oil lamps and the corner over there where he used to play. And maybe that chair, it might still remain empty where he used to sit and listen to the teachings and administration of his adopted grandfather. I wonder what Moses is feeling, having to flee for his life from that place and then walk back in. And there he is, sitting there, serpent on his head and flail in one hand and crook in the other on his throne. Can you imagine the clash of titans? It's going to begin. The facilitator of demons and the message of Jehovah. But the purpose wasn't just for Jehovah to show his power. He longs for people. Hebrew, Egyptian, Moses, Pharaoh. He longs for people to know him by experience. In Exodus 9, tells Pharaoh, "Let my people go so that they may worship me, or this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you, Pharaoh, and your officials and your people, so that you, Pharaoh, may know that there is no one like me in all the earth." Amen. To the Egyptians, in Exodus 7, "And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand." See, what have they seen all their lives? Pharaoh. God says, "When I stretch out my hand against the Egyptians, against Egypt, and bring the Israelites out of it." To the Israelites, he says in Exodus 6, "I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God." Pharaoh, let my people go. In Exodus 5, 2, Pharaoh said, "Who is Jehovah?" You've got to just sort of stand back and take that in. "That I should obey him and let Israel go. I do not know Jehovah, and I will not let Israel go." Well, brother, you're about to find out. Jehovah's shepherd's crook goes down to the ground and it becomes a serpent. And the sorcerers, the other priests, the under priests of Pharaoh, they throw their shepherd's crooks down and theirs become serpents as well. But, now just imagine this, if this was the throne room and here we are and Pharaoh's here and there's the sorcerers here and Moses is there and his crook is a serpent, and their crooks are serpents, but his goes and gobbles up all of theirs. And Moses picks it up And now it's in his hands. Can you catch the imagery? And how baffled maybe the sorcerers are, and how angry Pharaoh is. It's an amazing thing. He says, plague number one, Pharaoh, let my people go. No, I have the gods in one hand and the people in the other hand. I'm not going to let them go. Osiris is the god of the Nile, representing the stream of life in Egypt, the one who brings life from death, the giver of all life to Egypt. I'm Jehovah. Moses, touch your staff to the water. Aaron, point your staff at the waters in the land, and they become what? You know the stories. Blood. The water turns to blood. The magicians, with their demonic power, they point to some water as well, and it turns to blood. How thirsty are you? How well does this work? Interestingly, the sorcerers, these magicians with demonic power, they don't return it from blood to water. Now that would have been a trick. Plague number two, Pharaoh, let my people go. No. Absolutely not. I have the gods in one hand and the people in the other, and I'm in control. No. Heket. Heket is the frog-headed god. Heket is the one who brings new life during the spring when you see frogs pop up all over the banks. See, they're associating the frogs with new life and springtime. I'm Jehovah. Pharaoh. Aaron, stretch out your staff and make frogs come up all over the land of Egypt. And he does. And these sorcerers with their demonic power, they make some frogs pop up too. I think it would have been a better thing to make the frogs go away. But they don't. Plague number three. Let my people go. Absolutely not. Gods and people and authority and power rest in me. Okay. Geb. This is the god of dust and dirt. Strange god. But the god of dust and dirt who provides the harvest. I'm Jehovah. Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the land. And the dust becomes gnats. Have you ever seen anybody walking through a swarm of gnats? It's kind of funny. If you're at a distance, you don't see the gnats. You're just wondering what they're, you know, you cross the street. Someone looks crazy. These gnats are everywhere. They're all over. They're in your house. They're in your hair. They're in your nose. Take a deep breath and swallow. And the magicians, these sorcerers, these under-priests of Pharaoh with their demonic powers cannot now duplicate this miracle. And at this point, and this is very important to our study as we go through this year, at this point, they turn to Pharaoh and they say, this is the finger of Jehovah. This is beyond us. This is more than us. Plague number four, let my people go, Pharaoh. Nope. Gods and people. I have the power. I am the power. Nephthys is the protector of the households of Egypt. It's like the family god. I'm Jehovah. And I'm going to send swarms of flies into the palace and into the houses of the land, but not in the land of Goshen. Just everywhere else. Do you like flies? They don't like flies either. All over the food, all over the water, coming in and out everywhere. Pharaoh, let my people go. Absolutely not. I am the authority. I've been given authority from the gods and I will rule it over the people. No. Apis is the bull god of fertility, or Hathor is the bull goddess, or the cow goddess of fertility. And Jehovah, I'm going to cause all of the livestock belonging to the Egyptians to die, but none of the livestock of the Israelites. All of those cows and bulls throughout the land, keel over. Cow tipping time. These cows don't get back up. Plague 6. Pharaoh, let my people go. No. I hold the gods in one hand and the people over the other. I'm the dangerous one here. I'm the one who strikes. Not you. Thoth, the god of wisdom, the god of the moon, the god of medicine and good health. I'm Jehovah. Toss soot, Moses. Toss soot into the air, and it's going to become festering boils on men and animals. Where's your God now? Where's your healing God of good health? Plague number 7. Pharaoh, let my people go. No! Seth, the god of wind and storm. Think of it, the god of swirling chaos. I'm Jehovah. Moses, stretch out your hand to the sky. The worst hailstorm Egypt has ever seen, except in the land of Goshen. Plague 8. Pharaoh, let my people go. Absolutely not. Nope. I will not. Isis, the god of magic, the goddess of agriculture. I'm Jehovah. Moses, stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt so locusts will swarm over the land and devour all the plants. Wipe out their fields. Wipe out their harvest. No animals. No crops. Pain, boils, sickness, flies, gnats. This is one party. Plague 9. Pharaoh, let my people go. I am Pharaoh. I will not. Amun-Ra is the god of the sun, the chief of all gods, the one who rises and sets, precision, the god who brings order to the land, the god from whom Pharaoh descends. I'm Jehovah. Moses, stretch out your arm to the sky so darkness will spread over the land. And for 3 days, there was darkness. And it's interesting because it says it could be felt. Have you ever felt darkness like that for that long? But the Israelites had light where they were. I can't imagine what that was like. A flashlight shining down. I don't know. Just a beam of light right over the land of Goshen. Something you need to know is that the Egyptians held images of male sheep and goats as sacred. They are everywhere. If you've seen any of these archaeological excavations, they line the streets. They're on all the corners. The roads that lead up to the temples or the important places, even the marketplace, sheep, goat, sheep, goat, sheep, goat, sheep, just like that. They're everywhere. You can barely go anywhere without seeing an image of a male sheep or a male goat. I'm going to ask you to slaughter that. He's asking them to take a sacred thing to the culture and to the people around them and publicly slaughter this. Destroy it. And brazenly take its blood and put it on the doorposts of their house. You know, if they do this, they can be taken and stoned to death. This is a life or death step for these Israelites. He's asking them, are you committed to me like I'm committed to you? Have you, like the magicians, seen the finger of Jehovah yet? Are you going to keep serving the system of these demons that oppresses you, enslaves you, from which you're crying out? Are you going to keep serving the system that everybody around you believes in with all their heart? There's a problem when you agree with them. There's a problem when you agree with the philosophy and the culture around you. Or are you going to put its blood on your doorposts? Are you willing to say, I no longer serve this system. I no longer believe that it's the strongest thing around. You have shown me the finger of Jehovah. I worship the one true God. See, this was their step of faith here. This was their act of faith. Plague number 10. Pharaoh, let my people go. Now! No. Stiff-necked, hardened heart. I have the power of the gods in this hand. And I rule over the people with this one. Osiris, the God of resurrection, the God of life, the giver of eternal life, the ruler of the underworld, I'm Jehovah. Every firstborn son in Egypt will die tonight, except where there's shed blood on the wood. If you believe in the smallest way that there is something or someone other than Jehovah that can bring shalom or irene to your life, you have created an idol. Order. Order is experienced through tranquility in your own mind or in your own heart, or harmony between those around you and yourself. Order is experienced as wholeness, nothing missing, fullness, no empty space, completion, nothing unfinished. Order is experienced as safety in this moment, or security from here on. Order is experienced in favor, knowing that you're loved. If you're pursuing something or someone in order to achieve that, to accomplish that, to have a bit of that, a taste of that for yourself, you have created an idol. Idols are powerful. And our culture, our world, has created a lot of them for us to gaze upon. Sculpted by Satan himself. They're appealing. They're appealing. They're alluring. They draw us in, and doggone it, if in their power they don't give us a taste. A taste of what we're looking for. A little taste of what they promise. But they always lead to oppression and enslavement to them, to the system, to the things the culture believes. They always lead to chaos. They're futile. They're empty. They will always, always, always let you down. And then, once you've experienced that and you realize that, you are a slave to the pursuit. Because you try harder or you try different. But you keep trying. God is calling all of us to have the same commitment the Hebrews had. They had seen some of the things God could do. Have you? Have you? They have seen God's power. They have seen God's fearful authority. They have seen God protect them when everyone else around them suffered. Have you? Have you in any way experienced the finger of God? And then he asked them, okay, I've shown you some, I've shown you a bit, I've shown you a little, here you go, you now commit to me. Slaughter, destroy, shed the blood of the sacred things of the culture around you. No longer follow the gods of this worldview. No longer follow the system of the world around you. No longer follow the system that the prince of darkness and enslavement has put in place. Our God has defeated the gods of this world. We're free to walk away from the land. We're no longer bound. We're no longer in chains. But doggone it, if some of us just don't hang on to that system. Hang on to the things we've been told, the things we've seen that are powerful and alluring. We're free to follow the feeder of thousands with just some fish and bread. We're free to follow the one who can open up a fish and find a coin. We're free to follow Jehovah who can open the eyes of the servant to see the heavenly hosts standing ready. We're free to follow Jehovah who restored the woman at the well. We're free to follow the one who opened the eyes of the blind, ears of the deaf, made the lame walk again, and made whole the lepers. We're free to follow the one who took death and brought back life. Their story is, are you willing to be the one who says, if this world believes it, rallies around it, waves its banner, not only do I disagree, but I slaughter it. And I follow the only one who can bring real peace. Ephesians 6, 10 and 12. Finally, brethren, be strong in the Lord and in His mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. Take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against, but against the rulers and against the authorities and against the powers of this dark world and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Jesus himself said in Luke 11, 20, but if I drive out demons by the finger of God, then the kingdom of God has come to you.